This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
Welcome, everybody, to Beersmith Podcast number 75. You're going to enjoy today's show. We're talking about historic beer brewing with Ron Pattison. In announcements, I'd like to announce that, first of all, we've been updating the video for Beersmith, and starting with this episode, number 75, we're going to be having all of our video done in a DVD-style format, which would be a much higher resolution, and also better quality audio on the video, so I hope you'll enjoy that. You can enjoy that at our YouTube channel, or you can go to beersmith.com/blog and watch any of the episodes after 75. We'll have the updated video. Next announcement is Beersmith 2.2 is out for the desktop. I think most of you have that by now, but if you haven't got the update, grab it from beersmith.com. And you can also download a free trial version if you don't have Beersmith already. Again, that's Beersmith 2.2 desktop. I also have an update coming very shortly to the mobile version, and I think you'll enjoy that. We're going to be doing mobile updates near the end of February. It's now early February 2014. At the end of February, I'm going to be releasing an update to the mobile version. And finally, I want to thank our sponsor for this week, which is Critter Cutter at CritterCutter.com. It's a stainless steel tool. It's got a church key. It's got a box cutter. It's got a bottle opener, including twist-off bottle opener and the church key to open your regular bottles. It's a very handy tool. I've had mine for a couple months now, and I carry it with me everywhere. Really enjoy it. Again, you could thank our sponsor by contacting them at CritterCutter.com. And now, without further ado, let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, my guest is Ron Pattison. He's an all-around beer obsessive, irrationally interested in beer bottle stoppers, Scottish beer, and anything connected with Barley Perkins. He's the author of The Homebrewer's Guide to Vintage Beer, and he also runs a blog, which we'll talk about in just a minute. Ron, it's great to have you on the show. How are you doing?
Very well. It's a pleasure to be here to talk with you.
You're coming at us from the Netherlands, I believe, right?
Yes, I live in Amsterdam. I've lived here for a long time, 25 years.
Fantastic. Well, it's great to have you here. And today we're going to talk a little bit about vintage beers. And I was wondering if you could just start by talking about what a vintage beer is.
A vintage beer, you could call it an historic beer. It's a beer that's brewed to an old recipe. So one that, in my case, I go back to the brewing records. I analyze them, work out what the beer should have tasted like. What the ingredients are, what the recipe is, the mashing temperatures, all that sort of stuff. Turn it into a modern recipe, and then someone will brew it up.
So, I mean, you have to go all the way back and try and figure out how they brewed it, too, probably, right?
I mean, the brewing records vary. There's some that have stuff in great detail. There's others that are a bit vague. But there's a lot of stuff you can fill in with from the technical publications that they had at the time. So there's stuff going back to 1700 is the oldest one I have, which is a book that explains how to brew, basically. And so there's a long tradition of it. So you can use this information and couple that with the stuff that's in the brewing records. And between the two, you can get a pretty good idea of how they brewed.
Now, Ron, you've been brewing for a long time. How'd you get into beer brewing and eventually get interested in historical beers?
Well, I've been brewing. Well, I've brewed in the past. I haven't brewed for a while. The way it works now is I find the recipes and then I get a professional brewer who really knows what they're doing to brew the beer for me. It works very well. Me and Dan have a very good relationship. He wants old recipes and I want them brewed. So between us, we both get what we want.
So who's that you're talking about?
This is Dan of Pretty Things. They're from Somerville in Massachusetts.
Oh, fantastic. So you work with him to brew old beers, I assume.
Yeah, we've done a whole series of beers together. I mean, it all came about because we were, Dan and Martha once had an unscheduled stop in Amsterdam. I already knew them both. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh, I'll come down and have a couple of beers. And while we were there and we got talking – me and Dan got talking about old beers and stuff, and we thought, well, okay, well, maybe we can do something together. And so the whole idea of the Once Upon a Time series came from there. And we've done, I think, 6 or 7 beers now. And I've been very pleased with the beers. It's mostly been a very selfish enterprise for me because I've just been trying to get them to brew the beers that I really like, or the beers that I really wanted to try. And Dan, he seems to get a kick out of it as well. And they've gone down pretty well, the beers in general. Seem to have been quite well received. Even the suicidally obscure ones like the 2.8% mild.
Well, we're going to focus a little bit about English beers today. I was wondering if you could talk perhaps a little bit about some of the popular English styles and how they evolved.
Oh, English styles. Well, I mean, if you go back to when I started drinking in the 1970s, you had a fairly limited range of styles. In terms of draft beer, all you'd really got left was mild, bitter, a few old ales, a few strong ales, maybe at Christmas. And not much else. You didn't have any draft stouts anymore, apart from Guinness. It was quite limited. And then you had a range of bottled beers, which is now completely extinct. So things like light ale, brown ale, sweet stout, all strange things that really became associated with the little old men and little old women sitting in the corner with a half of bottled beer. And so it completely disappeared from memory. And so something like light ale, which at one time every brewery made, there's probably not more than 3 or 4 brewed in the whole country. Brown ale is quite similar. They've virtually completely disappeared, the old-fashioned sort. So British beer styles have always been changing, and the types of beers you can get have always been changing. What you've also seen since then, of course, is that you've got older styles have come back. And so now you do get draft porters, you do get draft stouts. There are a whole range of beers that hadn't been brewed for quite a while. But it's always been the case that the British beer scene has been constantly dynamic. And that's the one thing that struck me about investigating the past was just how dynamic it was and how there was virtually never any long period of stasis. That there was always something going on. And it was mostly external to the breweries themselves. It was either some sort of legislation, changes in the ingredients that were available, changes in the supply of ingredients. So like in World War I and World War II, mm-hmm. where they basically just couldn't get hold of the ingredients. And so then they had, if you look at the recipes that they brewed in wartime, there's some really weird ones. And the 1945 mild that Pretty Things brewed was a good example of that, because normally Barclay Perkins Exile, which is what it was, Barclay Perkins was one of the big London breweries. Mm-hmm. They were for a while the largest brewery in the world. Their Exile, their 1945 one, has got all sorts of different ingredients in it, loads of malts. It's got brown malts in it. It's got, I think, amber malt as well. It's got quite a lot of dark malts. Whereas normally, before the war, it had no dark malt whatsoever. It had nothing darker than crystal in it. And the colour all came from, the typical way, the colour all came from caramel and number 3 invert sugar.
A lot of the classic English ales developed around London. And
I would say the classic English beers as opposed to ales.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Because the thing that London really gave to the world is porter and stout, and they're beers by the original classifications. But if you were to define them in the 19th century, they both have been called brown beers. Mm-hmm. And it came at a certain point because beer came to be so associated just with porter and stout that they actually came to think that beer, if you read something from around 1800, they'll say beer is dark and ale is pale in colour. And so I think this is one of the reasons why pale ale, which is actually a beer by 19th century classifications rather than ale, because it's very heavily hopped, mm-hmm. is actually called an ale, just because people had come to associate the word beer with something of a dark colour.
Porter is a good example. It was wildly popular, wasn't it, at the end of the 17th century and into the 18th century? Well,
Porter was wildly popular for a long time. If you're talking about in London,
yeah,
really from about 1740 to probably about 1860, mm-hmm. 1870, Porter was the most popular style of beer. That's the standard bottom of the line ordinary porter. And after that, you get mild that takes over.
Right.
But porter was a big, big style for a long, long time. And in London, right up until the First World War, it was a big seller. In the rest of the country, it tended to die off at the end of the 19th century. And you see breweries are discontinuing it from about the 1870s onwards. They still brew stouts, but they don't brew porter anymore. And it gradually ebbs away from most of the country. And the last place it remained was in the southeast, but particularly in London. And in terms of London porter, it was actually killed off by World War II. Mm-hmm. So you see that Barclay Perkins and Whitbread, they continued brewing their porter, even though after World War I, the popularity really fell off. So they were brewing tiny quantities of it. But they kept on brewing it until the first couple of years of the war, and then they dropped it just because they were rationalizing their beer line ranges. Right. They had to cut down the number of beers they brewed, and so porter was an obvious one to go because they were brewing so little. But you, if you look at the amount they were brewing, I mean, when you see that they were doing like 60 barrels mm-hmm. in a time when at Whitbread, when the brewery, the equipment was actually turning out 1,200 barrel batches, and they were party guiling it, but just in tiny, tiny quantities. It was probably just an emotional reason why they kept on brewing it, just because that was the beer that had made the brewery famous, and they didn't want to let it go. But eventually they did.
And of course, today it's had quite a resurgence, hasn't it? I mean, we've seen porter really take off, at least here in the United States.
Yes, in Britain, it's one of the things that really heartened me was the comeback of porter, because I was really interested in it. It's partly to do with exactly when I grew up and the sort of things that I read. So, I mean, I started drinking beer in 1973, or somewhere around there, when I was about 15, 16, as you did in Britain at the time. If I say to some of this, I was explaining this story, telling a story to some American friends recently about how the school, the secondary school I went to, there was a pub just on the edge of the playing fields. And at lunchtime, kids from the school would go down there in their school uniforms and drink beer. And there would be teachers in the bar as well. And they'd be there drinking in the pub together, and no one found that at all strange at the time. They would do now, unfortunately. They've sort of caught some of the ridiculous puritanism of some other countries, but it used to be pretty relaxed when I was younger. So I started drinking in about 1973, which is about exactly the year, I think, when Guinness discontinued porter in Northern Ireland, and that was the last of British porter. And so for me, it was like a mythical beer, porter, that it was this thing that had just disappeared before I'd had time to try it. And I had no idea what it tasted like, and I really wanted to try it. And I remember that in the late 70s, you had a couple of breweries that brought it back. Some of the earliest, well, Timothy Taylor's actually were one of the first that brought one back in the late 70s. And also the brewery, what was it, Penrose Court, the one that one of the Monty Python people was involved in, they had a porter. But I never thought either of those were right. They didn't fit. I don't know. It sounds crazy when I say this, but my idea of what porter should taste like came from a dream I once had, where I dreamt that I was in a pub and I was drinking porter because I'd been obsessed with it. And it had this particular taste, which is like a cross for me between dark mild and bottled Guinness.
Right.
And that always struck me as what porter should taste like. And it still does to some extent cloud my view of what I think porter tastes like. But when I've had porters, that has been what they've tasted like, because that's what porter is. It's like a sort of milder version of stout, really.
So you made a pretty good guess there, huh?
I hope so, yeah. Or I could just have been completely wrong and I've been fooling myself for the whole of my life.
Well, a lot of the ingredients used in vintage beers were not the same as the ingredients we had today. And I was wondering if you could just start maybe by talking about malts, for example.
Oh, malts. that's such
a brilliant one. They changed quite a bit.
Some more than others. The huge problem is brown malt, brown and amber malt. And anyone who says they can brew an 18th century style porter is a liar unless they're making their own malt, because you can't. Because porter and stout in the 18th century, the original ones, they were 100% brown malt beers made from diastatic brown malt. No one's made it on a commercial scale for I don't know how long. Probably more than...
Weren't most of them dried or kilned over fire, over wood fires too?
A lot of them? No.
Early on, no.
Right. There were loads of different ways of making malt. And what they used in London Porter was Hertfordshire brown malt. You can see it in the records. It often says HB. The H stands for Hertfordshire, the B for brown malt. HB and HP and pale malt from Hertfordshire. And I can say in the early 19th century London breweries, virtually all the malt is coming from Hertfordshire. And the way they dried it there was with straw. And the old 18th century sources say, if you dry it with straw, it doesn't taste smoky. If you dry it with wood, it does.
Right.
And so the old sources say this. I know someone who's been playing around with doing some malting based on the things that some of the stuff I've published, based on old sources. And he's managed to make diastatic brown malt, kilning it with straw, just on a small scale in his back garden in a barbecue. Or something like that. It's some weird little arrangement. It looked a little scary because the flames sort of come up. But the thing about something like brown malt is, like I was saying about things being dynamic, brown malt was never just one thing. I'd say that there are at least three different types of brown malt made historically. You've got the diastatic brown malt, the stuff where you could make a beer 100% from it. Then what you have happen when you have the introduction of the hydrometer from the 1770s onwards, which coincides with a period when there was the tax on malt was going up because there were wars with France. And then you can see that the porter brewers realized that brown malt isn't as cheap as it seems to be, because you don't get the same extract from it that you do from pale malt. They'd never been able to measure it before. Once they could, because these were big, very commercial concerns.
Right.
You know, that one of the reasons they started using the hydrometer was for this, so that they knew how strong their beers were, how much malt they had to use. And you can see at a time when malt's becoming more expensive, the less malt you use, the cheaper you're going to make your beer, and you've got a commercial advantage over your rivals. And so you see that then they started changing the grists. They start using a large proportion of pale malt. It just keeps going up and up and up. Until when you see by the early 1800s, porter's 65% pale malt, 35% brown malt. Now, if you've got that mix, you don't need the brown malt to be diastatic anymore.
Right.
So my guess is, I don't know this for sure, but if I look at the percentages they're using, if it's the old style brown malt, the beer's not going to be dark enough. So my guess is that they started kilning the brown malt more in the late 18th century, just so they could get more color out of it. Because they thought, well, there's no point in it being diastatic. At some point, it moved from being diastatic to non-diastatic. My guess would be this is when it happened, because this is when it didn't need to be diastatic anymore. So it makes sense that would be when the change would take place.
I guess if you use more pale malt too, you'd be lightening the colors you go too. So they probably wanted to bring it back to where
this is the thing that you wouldn't need the diastatic power anymore, but you'd need more color. So my guess is that they started kilning it more at this point.
Right.
And that might be when they went over to the hornbeam method. And this guy I know, he's also done brown malt by this later method, which is the hornbeam one, where you do it with wood. But hornbeam is a very specific sort of hardwood. It will burn really hot, but with a really small amount of smoke. And when you see that, you see, okay, they specifically, and it says in the old text, specifically hornbeam that they're using. If they're saying that, hornbeam, they're using it for a reason. And the reason probably is that it doesn't give off very much smoke, but at intense heat.
So
they're heating it up for a short period, really, really high. So they get a really dark color on it. It's very interesting. I'm supposed to be doing a book on malt with the guy who's been doing these experiments. What we're going to do is he's going to publish how to make the malt, how to use these old methods to make these different types of brown malt from the past. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to do some other stuff about the history of malting and things like that. It's one of my 700 projects that I've got going at the moment.
We all seem to take on too many projects. Can you talk for a minute about hops? Hops have evolved quite a bit as well, haven't they?
I should go back to
malt. Or do you want to go back and talk about amber malt?
Well, amber malt's a story into itself. But I was in Manchester talking to some brewers on Saturday, and one of them was saying he'd got hold of some Chevalier malt, some Chevalier barley. So Chevalier, you know, the thing with malt and hops is that even something like Marisotto isn't very old as a variety. It's only a couple of decades old. Hops, it's a different story. And so when I did a couple of beers with Fuller's, they got hold of Plumage Archer, which is the oldest type of barley they could get. It was from about 1910, I think, that variety. Mm-hmm. And it was really difficult to get hold of that. And there were no varieties from the 19th century available, unlike with hops. And so this guy said to me, oh, he got hold of some Chevalier, which is from, I don't know the exact date, but I think about 1850. Mm-hmm. And I was asking him, well, we were all asking him because there were a couple of brewers there. And they said, well, what's the difference with this? Is it really different to modern malt? And what he said was, oh, it tastes a lot maltier, which is sort of quite a slightly strange thing to say, but I sort of get the idea. And so I'm intrigued. And evidently some people had got, it hadn't been grown for decades.
I was surprised. I think we had a guest on a few months ago who was talking about malt, and they said that, you know, there's really only a handful of different varieties of malt that are commercially grown for beer brewing.
Today. Well, Marisotto. That was at risk of being delisted. I think it was only because brewers actually paid farmers to grow it for them that it kept going. Because otherwise, the barley varieties turn over really, really quickly. Mm-hmm. But the whole thing about these heritage varieties, I mean, really excites me. And it seems they do have them in seed banks. But obviously, to get enough seeds to be growing them on a really commercial scale takes time, because you have to, if you've only got a handful of seeds,
right?
You know, it takes you a while to get sacks full of them. But I think it's a really exciting development, and it's one way that you can get back to the flavor of these beers better, I think, by having something more like the right barley varieties. Then you have to worry about malting. But I know a guy who's got a small pilot malting, so I'm hoping that he's going to be able to do some stuff with me as well. But
Let's switch over for a minute to hops and talk about hops for a minute.
Hops. Oh, yeah, hops.
I mean, because, you know, for one thing, our knowledge has increased dramatically about hops, but go ahead.
Well, hops in terms of historic brew. I'm not a hop expert, but I know a couple of people who are. And when they've spoken to me about it, it's way more complicated than well, why should I be surprised it's way more complicated? Everything's way more complicated than you really think. It's way more complicated than I thought. And so I had this naive belief that that Mr. Golding had, you know, taken these plants and propagated them, and we were still using the benefits of clones from those plants today.
Right.
And it turns out that, well, no, the stuff that's called Goldings now probably aren't actually descended from those, from Goldings plants. There's something very similar, and there's a whole load of very similar types of nicely flavored Kent hops that have got mixed up and been called different things, and I don't know. It lost me the story, and I'm glad I didn't have to try and work it all out. So, there's loads of what's called Goldings. Yeah, are they really Goldings? Well, they're that type of hops. It's the type of really top quality hops you had grown in Kent, and also the stuff that were Farnham hops. So it's all these varieties of white vine hops, which were the ones that had the flavor people liked. And so they've stuck around. And I don't quite know why hops have stuck around so much better, hop varieties, than barley varieties. Because if I look at the old records, I mean, I often say SARS coming up. I mean, SARS, this is always a good one in William Younger, so it's Scottish beer with SARS in them. Or I've seen the London beers from the 1930s that were dry hopped with SARS. And actually, British brewers, SARS was one of the few hops, foreign hops, they really liked. They thought it was a classy hop. There's virtually no other foreign hop that they've used to dry hop, because that's where you're getting the real nice flavor from the hop. Mm-hmm. Stuff like American hops, they always threw them in right at the start of the boil because they didn't like the flavor very much. And Hallertau, they might use them later as aroma hops. But in general, it was only the German and the Czech hops that they'd ever use for any sort of flavor addition.
Now, what about the handling and processing of hops? It must have changed pretty dramatically over the years, right?
Well, that's a good question. How hops are harvested? Yeah,
Now we have refrigeration, and we have they're dried in a certain way, and everything else.
Well, I think one of the great things I found was in a brewing manual from the 1930s. They had analyses of hops where they'd analyzed them over time, and they had them stored either just in the open or in a cold store, which is where they normally kept them. Mm-hmm. Because it's really easy to think that cooling only started in the 1870s when you have the sort of ammonia refrigerator type machines,
right?
But that's not the case. The things were cooled before then.
I was going to say lagers were certainly brewed before then, right?
Yes, there were plenty of ways of cooling before then. Mm-hmm. And so hops had been stored cold for a long time. I was really confused for a while by something I saw in brewing records where it got the hops. And then after the hops, it got CS written. And I saw this over loads and loads of different breweries and different records. I thought, what on earth does this mean? And then eventually I realized, oh, yeah, it means cold store. Because I saw that what they said was that what they did with the hops was that they'd keep them out just uncooled for the first couple of months. And then at a certain point, they put them into the cold store. And so obviously the brewers wanted to know if the hops had been in the cold store or not. Mm. And that's why they put CS after it. And so if you look at these analyses from the 30s, where they're looking at the alpha acids and the beta acids of hops, the ones in the cold store only deteriorated by about 5% over the first 18 months. And the methods they were using for storing the hops then were basically the same as they'd been since about the 1850s. So my guess is that they kept the hops in pretty good shape because they'd want to. They'd had lots of practice with this. They deliberately packed the hops really tightly into the sacks, and then they put them into a cold store. They knew how to try and minimize the deterioration. And the difference between the ones that were stored the way they'd really store them mm-hmm. and the ones that were just stored out was huge.
I would imagine yeah.
It's in one of my books, all of this. The wonderfully entitled piece, which is about British brewing in the 1920s and 1930s. So, but that's one of the nuggets in it.
So which book is that?
Piece.
Okay. Well, we'll definitely look for that.
It's coupled with the one that comes before it, which is War.
Well, let's move on to yeast. Yeast wasn't even understood until I guess Louis Pasteur discovered it.
That really annoys me. Yeast wasn't understood. Yeast was understood quite well. What people didn't know was exactly what yeast was,
right.
What type of organism. Some people had guessed before Pasteur that it was a type of fungus. But just because people didn't know it was a type of fungus didn't mean they didn't understand a lot about yeast. People had been brewing with it and baking with it for
thousands
of years.
Yeah.
They knew something about it. They weren't completely ignorant. And you can say that if you look at the brewing records, they always say where the yeast came from. And the yeast comes from a previous brew. That's what it always is.
Right.
It will say, it will give the guyl number, and sometimes it will say what type of beer it was as well, so which beer it was. But it will always say what the guyl number was of where the yeast came from. It might have come... They might use yeast from a couple of different guiles.
So, I mean, they would do the same thing we do today. They would, culture it as a slurry from a previous batch, right?
Yeah, exactly. They were just repitching the yeast. They didn't necessarily have to mess around very much because in London, these are breweries where they're churning beer out. They're brewing huge quantities of it.
Right.
And as part of the process, they're skimming yeast off the top of it. I mean, partly it's for the brewing, for the fermentation, but also it's partly to get the yeast off to put into another brew. And so they'd just be using the yeast fresh normally because they got all this yeast anyway. You just take it from the one brew, plonk it in the other one.
But so are you talking about the Burton method where they kind of skim the yeast off the top of the beer and...
Well, the Burton method. I assume you're talking about unions. Unions.
Burton union method is what I meant. Yeah.
Yeah. Unions are a method of cleansing. The mm-hmm. beer would have gone through a primary fermentation before being put into the unions.
Okay.
In these tiny little rounds that they had in Burton, it's very strange that Bass could brew a million barrels a year, and their fermenters weren't any larger than 100 barrels.
How do they do that?
they had just hundreds of them. It's very strange. But British brewers were weird. They had their ways of doing things, and they organized their breweries differently or have different equipment based on where they were. So, I mean, if you're talking about yeast, which I think we were, the brewers in Yorkshire and parts of it wasn't just Yorkshire, but also bits of Nottinghamshire and Derbyshire and some other bits of the north where they had the thing called the square. It's normally called the Yorkshire square. This is something where you have a very specific type of yeast because it's being sprayed all over the place all the time. It's being roused continually. It's a very specific type of fermentation, and you had to have the right type of yeast, otherwise it wouldn't work.
Yeah, I'm trying to find an image of it. I can't find a good one here, but I will eventually.
There's one in my book.
Oh, is
in my new book, there's an image of it. I'm actually drinking one of the beers out of the book.
Which beer is that?
Oh, is it in the book? It might not. This exact one might not be, but this is a book. This is a beer that I did with Dan. I was actually there when this was brewed in Buzzards Bay in February. This is Younger's Number One.
Younger's Number One.
It doesn't say Younger's Number One. But it's actually Younger's Number One.
Send me the recipe, and I can put it in the show notes if you like.
Send me an email and remind me, and I can send it out. I've got the recipe.
Do we find a lot of these yeast strains today? I mean, have some of these actually continued on all the way to today?
I think that there's a lot of British breweries who still, the older ones, who still use very old yeast strains. Usually breweries are very reluctant to change them. My guess would be that Harvey's has a very old yeast strain. I know that Fuller's, their yeast strain, they cut it down from 3 to 1. They used to have a triple strain until when they went all over to conical fermenters in sometime in the 1970s. And then they cut it down to 1. But I think though that was very old, probably going back to the 19th century. Yeast sticks around, and you can put it in yeast banks as well. So there's loads of old yeast strains. This was a great thing when we I had a thing where we brewed a Grodziski beer. Me and a couple of people with a commercial brewery.
We just covered that. I think it was either the last episode or the episode before that. We talked about that beer. Spent a whole episode on it, actually.
Okay. Well, we tried really, really hard to do it properly. So we got 100% oak spoke malt. We got the right yeast strainers. This is where I was going. Was that the last brewery making it shut down in the early 1990s. This is one of my biggest regrets, that I was in Poland before that and I never got to try the beer because it was a beer I knew about and I really, really wanted to try. But the last head brewer put the yeast into a yeast bank. And so the yeast, which is which has a very specific flavor and which is part of the genuine Grodziski character,
right,
has been preserved. And so Evan Rail, who's an American beer writer who lives in Prague, there's a yeast bank there who'd got it. They cultured it up for him, and he brought it over, and we used that to ferment the Grodziski.
Yeah, I pulled it up here. We covered it in podcast number 73, which was 2 episodes ago, and. He talked about, I think that he talked about
I hope
two
they
different.
Didn't say it was, I hope they didn't say it was sour.
No. In fact, he was pretty strongly saying that it wasn't sour. Actually, the guest that we had on it was Stan.
Stan Hieronymus.
Yeah,
it's Stan.
Yeah, Stan was the guest,
of course,
right here. I'll pull it up right here. You can see it right here, Stan Hieronymus, episode 73. He mentioned there was 2 yeast strains, I guess, and one of them has survived on. I think it's the one you're talking about. And one of them, they're having a hard time still finding exactly that, you know, that one yeast strain, if you will, is what he mentioned.
But it's one of the good things about yeast. This is it's strange that you'd think that yeast maybe that wouldn't have survived as well as barley strains. But in fact, old yeasts are much easier to come by than the old strains of barley are.
Right.
And I guess the thing is with yeast, you don't need to keep very much of it. And you can culture it up quite quickly. Whereas with something like seeds, it's much, much more difficult. So even if it has been kept, it's a lot more difficult to get it back into actual production qualities. Talking of yeast, Scottish breweries, they're a good one with yeast. Because I told you that in brewing records, they virtually always say where the yeast came from. Because obviously it was clearly important for them for tracking the quality of the beer, because you could see, oh, well, all the beers that came from this root, they were all infected. Then there's something wrong with the yeast.
I was wondering go ahead. I'm sorry. You were saying Scottish?
Yeah, Scottish breweries. They seem to have been, huge yeast swappers. It's funny, you think nowadays, oh, well, people are quite precious about which strain of yeast they're using and stuff. And there's some whole sections of the William Younger's records. That's one of the big Edinburgh breweries. Sure. There's whole chunks of them in the 1860s where they use yeast from, it's like a it's like a directory of Edinburgh breweries, the bit where it says where the yeast come from. So they use beer yeast from like a dozen different other breweries in town, and virtually never their own yeast. And I've seen it in other Scottish breweries where other Edinburgh breweries where they're using other people's yeast as well. And you think, well, did they actually really have their own yeast strains? When you've been doing that for a while, it's just going to be one mixed strain probably. And that's maybe why they could do that, because there probably wasn't any big difference between the yeast and the breweries. If they kept doing that, there's always yeast hanging around in the equipment. Basically, what you'd have had, it'd have been a Darwinian struggle between the various strains for who was the best one, which one survived best in the conditions in the breweries, and that, and maybe a couple of other ones would have won out. And you've ended up with just a couple of strains that everyone was passing around between them.
Interesting. Well, I was wondering if you could talk for a little bit about historical techniques and how techniques have actually evolved from the time we're talking about.
Okay, well, techniques, brewing techniques. Well, the big thing, mashing is a big one. If you look at mashing techniques before about 1850, in England, they were always using multiple mashes and varying numbers of them. The typical porter one, if you're looking... London Porter, 1800 to 1840 or so, typical thing would be four mashes at different temperatures. What looks to me like crazily different temperatures, some really oddly hot ones and some really quite cold. And you look at it and you think, well, what the hell were they doing? But I always think is, these were huge commercial enterprises that were making lots of money. They obviously weren't doing anything that was really stupid, because they wouldn't have been making any money if they were.
Right.
And I have had someone who's done one of these, what looks like a crazy mashing scheme, who's actually done all the four different mashes. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, oh, well, I've never had better efficiency out of any mash than that. And clearly, that's the reason why they were doing it. And they'd obviously worked out a way. This is why the whole thing about thermometers was a big thing in the breweries. Using thermometers, you could, and a hydrometer, you could really work out by trial and error, which is, I'm sure, what they did, how you could get the most out of the malt, what temperatures you mashed at, how long you mashed for, and what gravity wort you'd get out of it, and what efficiency.
Which, of course, turns into profit on the other end, right?
Yeah. One of the things you always see, what they always have written on the logs, is what the yield was, how many pounds per barrel they got from a quarter of malt. And you can see that that's a really important thing for them. And you look at the efficiency that they're getting, and it's really high. And Derek.
So were they doing something like some people do with lagers, for example, they do a sort of a modern mash where they sort of hit a low temperature and then hit a high temperature, trying to activate both the alpha and the beta amylase to get a higher efficiency to get a cleaner beer. Is that the kind of thing they're doing?
No, it's different. It's very different to the lager system of brewing. I mean, I don't know. There's some strange ones. There'll be some that will be really hot, so like maybe 190 degrees.
Wow.
And then one that will be, they'll say cold, so just cold water over it. So I suppose basically a cold sparge. It's very odd. But I remember Derek Prentice saying to me that this is a guy who's worked for loads of brewery. He was at Truman's and Young's and Fuller's. He said to me that the yield in this old fashioned system is about the same as the efficiency percentage. It's about approximately the same. So what you're looking at on these porters is about 85, 87. So that's about 85, 87% efficiency, I guess.
That's pretty good mash efficiency overall. Yeah.
But I mean, they these were professionals who've been practicing this for 60 years. So, you know, I guess they got the hang of it.
Very cool. I was wondering if you could talk about modern packaging and storage versus versus how things were packaged and stored originally.
Okay. I think you have to realize that you know that things right packaged and stored.
Well, obviously, it didn't. Right. Yeah, we didn't store.
You mean the finished beer?
I'm talking about the finished beer. Yeah.
Well, one of the great things you see in some old adverts from the 19th century is where they say about their stock beers, so their stock pale ales and their stock ales, where they'll say that they're guaranteed to be sound for at least 6 months in the cask if you don't open it.
So and 6 months, huh?
Yeah, at least 6 months. And they're not joking. It would have been.
Well, I had Charlie Bamforth on, I think it was last week, and he was talking about packaging and preserving flavor in beer, and he said even modern beers sort of hit their peak in the first 6 months. So maybe things haven't changed that much, huh?
Okay. they used to take a huge amount of time to make some beers.
Right.
The original IPAs were all stock pale ales. So stock beers means that they were aged for a huge length of time. If you say that the way bottled Bass was produced in the 19th century, right? Yeah. They'd brew it, they'd put it into barrels, they'd stack the barrels up out in the brewery yard in the open, and they'd leave them there for 9 months or 12 months. Wow. And if it got too hot, they'd throw some straw on them and put a bit of water on them, and otherwise they'd just leave them out there in the open.
Amazing. Right?
At the end of that, they'd send it either, if it was going abroad, they stick it on the ship. So if it was going to the tropics, they recommended leaving it in the yard for 12 months. If it was just for domestic use, they'd only have it there 9 months. And then they'd send it to the bottlers. He'd keep it for a couple of months. Then he'd bottle it, and then they'd leave it another couple of months before it was actually sold. Wow. So the classic IPA should never have been less than a year old when you drank it.
So what effect would that have on flavor then?
Well, I've had beers that are done the old-fashioned way, where you use loads of whole hops, where you have a lot of them in for a long part of the boil. And what you get is this, and I've seen it in descriptions of pale ales from the 19th century. People have described it this really, really long-lasting bitterness that just sticks there, just this really long, long note of it. So it's not about the aroma. You might get a bit of that in the beer because it had been dry hopped, but really it was about this really long-lasting, pure bitterness that you get. And if you have loads of good quality English hops, that's what you get.
So really, it somehow enhances the bitterness, is what you're saying?
It just means that you don't get the modern idea is the all the sort of floral, the fruity aroma parts.
Sure, all the oils and so on, hop oils.
In the old-fashioned IPA, it was purely about bitterness, that you would have had some flavor from the hops there, but it was really about this really pure, long-lasting bitterness. It's a different concept. People's tastes change. I mean, I'm not saying that modern IPA is something stupid or wrong. It's just different. And beers have always changed. I wouldn't expect them to be the same as beers that were brewed in the 19th century.
Sure. Well, one more question. How do you know what historic beers really tasted like? How can you tell?
How can I tell? What I can do is I can guess. The main reason that I started pestering brewers to brew things from the recipes I'd unearthed was so I could taste the beers. Purely selfish, really, because I knew I wouldn't be able to brew them well enough myself, and I wanted someone who knew what they were doing to try them to give the recipes a try. you can look at the descriptions. There are descriptions of varying quality in records and in literature, and mm-hmm. some of them, like I was saying about the description of the bitterness in IPA, I could equate to what I'd tasted in beers that were hopped in a way that those beers were. So I could understand that. But yeah, it's very difficult, and you don't ever really know. I just keep realizing there's never-ending levels of complexity in this. It's a bit like a fractal picture.
That's very complex.
Yeah, I've got the recipes, and now I'm thinking, oh, well, okay, I've got the hop varieties, but what about the malts? And what about the malting techniques? And how do you get to that? So, yeah, well, I'm hoping I'm going to be able to get some diastatic brown malt made on a commercial scale. It's one of my dreams, if only because I really want to be able to try Stitch, which is an 18th century London beer. It's the ale equivalent of a double stout, double brown stout. So a strong brown ale. But 100% brown malt.
That sounds really good to me too.
Yeah, until you get diastatic brown malt made the right way, you can't make it. So this is the frustrating thing. I got hold of the recipes, and then I realized that, oh, well, I had to source the ingredients as well.
I was wondering, we're getting near the end here, but I was wondering if we could spend a few minutes actually talking about your new book. Yeah, you got a new book. It's called, let me put it up here. It's called The Homebrewer's Guide to Vintage Beer, Rediscovered Recipes for Classic Brews from 1800 to 1965. And can you tell us a little bit about what's in the book?
What's in the book? It's basically a guide to trying to recreate historic English beers, with a couple of continental beers thrown in as well. I go through ingredients, brewing techniques, equipment of the various periods. Then there's a chapter on each style, and at the end with a bit about the history, how the style changed over time, and then at the end a series of recipes.
So sort of a nice guide for people looking to learn a little bit more about vintage beer.
Yes, and I think if you want to, I think it's the most accurate potted guide to British beer styles, because I don't know, it sounds like I'm showing off, but I think I've spent more time looking at the actual beers, so looking at the brewing records and all the details I could find about beers and how they were brewed, I think I know more about it than anyone else. I don't think anyone else has taken the time to look into it in the detail I have. So, I'm sorry. I shouldn't say that. I'm English. I'm not supposed to show off.
No, I think it's great. So let's see. I'm pulling it up on Amazon here. It's available on the Kindle as well as in printed form. Looks like a spiral bound form here in the US.
I thought the spiral bound form was a bit weird. And then someone said to me, oh, well, if you're actually a home brewer, it's quite handy because when you open it up, it stays out flat. You don't have to worry about the book folding up.
No, I think it's great. I think you mentioned you did some other books as well.
Well, I've done a whole series of self-published books. I would call them vanity books, but I have no vanity. I've done a whole load of self-published books, like Peace, I mentioned earlier. They mostly have one-word titles with an exclamation mark at the end. So, War, Peace, Mild, Bitter, Porter, Strong. It's all the British beer styles. I cover them all. A lot of them have got recipes in. The ones that are on British beer styles, so like Mild, that has a whole load of Mild recipes at the end. Genuine ones, which aren't really like what people think Mild probably is, but.
And then I noticed you have a blog as well. It's Shut Up About Barclay Perkins here. I'm putting it up now on the screen. Yeah. Where's that title come from?
That title comes from what my kids kept saying to me when I kept going on about Barclay Perkins after I'd been down the archives. They said, "Dad, shut up about Barclay Perkins." So I started writing the blog so that I didn't have to pester the family with all this stuff anymore. There was, and I was surprised that there were people who actually wanted to listen to it.
So that's, let's see, I'm reading the web address here. It says barclayperkins.blogspot.com, it looks like, is the web address there.
Yeah, Barclay, if you just Perkins. Type in chat about Barclay Perkins, it'll come up with me.
That's true, yeah. So, it comes up. It's the first one on Google if you type that in.
Yeah, so it's. I'm glad I picked such a crazy title, actually, because it's really distinctive.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Ron. I really appreciate you being on the show. It's been fantastic having you here.
Okay. Well, I was going to say that I'm going to be over in the States doing some stuff to promote the book.
Oh, sure. When's that?
In March. So I've got events the 8th of March at the Independent in Somerville in Boston.
Boston, okay.
So there'll be, I've persuaded Dan of Pretty Things to brew a Whitbread double brown ale, because that's, again, one of the beers I most wanted to try. So I'm glad I managed to.
So again, the date again and the location?
That's the 8th of March at the Independent in Somerville, Union Square in Somerville.
Right, in Massachusetts, near Boston.
In Massachusetts, yeah. So Boston, yeah. Then at the 10th, I'll be at the Brower Eye Lane in Brooklyn in New York. The 11th, I think it's at Yards, I'm not completely sure, in Philadelphia.
Philadelphia?
Yeah.
Are you coming near Washington? You know, I live near Washington.
Oh, well, the 15th, I'll be at, I'm doing something with Burp, the homebrewers in Washington.
Oh, fantastic.
At Three Stars in D.C.
Well, I look forward to that.
And then 16th in Baltimore at the Maryland Homebrew.
So this is all in March for folks who want to catch up on that. Well, thank you again, Ron. Really appreciate you being on the show, and encourage folks to go ahead and grab that book. It's, again, The Homebrewer's Guide to Vintage Beer, Rediscovered Recipes for Classic Brews Dating from 1800 to 1965, and also your blog at Shut Up About Barclay Perkins, which I think is a great title. And thank you, Ron. I really appreciate you being here.
No problem. It was a pleasure.
Well, I'd like to say thank you to Ron Pattison for appearing on the show. Really appreciate him being here. It's been great having him as a guest, teaching us about historic beer brewing. I'd like to remind you, if you haven't signed up for our newsletter, you can go to beersmith.com/blog or beersmith.com. On the right side, we have the newsletter box. All you do is put your name in there, put your email address in there, and then confirm your subscription, and you'll get an article on beer brewing every single week. I'd like to also mention our sponsors, Critter Cutter at crittercutter.com. Critter Cutter is an amazing little tool. I recommend you grab yours today. I've had mine for a couple months, really enjoy it. And if you don't mind, when you do order, please thank them for sponsoring Beersmith. You can go do that at crittercutter.com. Again, that's crittercutter.com. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.